Right, I'll reconvene.
Mr. Ferguson, just intended, my questions are more of an overview nature in terms of objectives and policies. So, and I realise that your changes to objectives that are in the plan are the ones that are set out in the plan and you've commented on those. But if I could take you to paragraph 71 on your evidence, please. Just where you've recommended the rewording of the objective. It's my understanding that objectives are providing like a goal, an aspiration statement. So I wonder, just in that example there, what's the goal there? Because the way, to me, to cut to the point, it reads more like a policy than what an objective is.
Yeah, I'm already reading it, I'll the provision as it is at the moment, whether you accept my person as a change or not, reads more like a policy.
You may not be aware, Mr. Ferguson, that we've set council officers off to reframe all the objectives to be objectives, and we're waiting for their revised version of them in the form of objectives.
I think we discovered that on the website this morning, their response.
Did you read it, us?
Oh, yeah.
So we haven't digested it either. It's pretty sorry,
you might be ahead of us.
Yeah, so there's a memorandum of council for the council stated 18th March, but I don't think it popped up until today. That has a marked up version doing what we just talked about. So we will need to reserve our position in terms of considering those changes.
I'm not concerned about a legal position on it. My query is in regards to an example for planning practice.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
I think you're right. It should be. It's an objective that needs to be expressed as a goal, something to be aspired to achieve, rather than from describing mechanisms of how, which is more in my mind the role of the policy. So if that stays as an objective, I agree, it could give us some recognition.
Yep. You're based in Christchurch, Mr. Peters?
No.
Oh, okay. You are in Queensland. Okay.
I've worked at
the last time. Okay. And I just wondered whether you've been involved at all in the Christchurch plans?
Yes.
Has issues come up regarding that you're aware of, that you might have been involved in regarding the difference between objectives and policies and how they should be structured?
Not that I can specifically recall, but my involvement in the replacement of Christchurch district plans have reasonably limited.
Okay. That's fine, it was just if you had any.
Yeah.
And then my other question related to paragraph 109 of your evidence, where you're referring to the goal, the use of the term goals, and as I understand, the objectives that they're identified in the plan. Is there a difference between the two? A goal and an objective?
Well, in theoretical terms, no. I think the goal, I think, is an objective. It's something to be aspired to achieve, as I said just before. I think what's been put into the plan through the goals reads more like an objective, an aspirational statement. Part of the belief that we saw in the submission from the Derby Planning was to actually rephrase a lot of the, one, you need to remove the two layers between the objectives and the goals, because I think they are, theoretically, they are the same thing. They should be the same thing. And I think it confuses interpretation, future interpretation. And I'm thinking, threshold test sort of thing, if you said, what's the objective, and where does the goal sit in that? And I read the evidence there of Mr. Pates on the issue. But it's not clear to me, and I think it could be interchangeable between goal and objective when you're reading as they're stating now. So I think there's a problem that needs to be resolved.
As alternative, could they be relabeled some other way to achieve the secretary recognition in some other way?
That discussion that you just referred to 189 sort of goes on and talks about a further discussion around just that hierarchy generally. But in terms of the goal, it could just be that you remove the word goal and just leave it as a heading. That would be one potential approach. Another one might be that you just incorporate the wording of the goal into the objective.
Mr. Baker Galloway, in terms of legally, from the legal position, given what Mr. Ferguson has just said, our example around the 104D tests, what do you see any issues with how it's phrased in the plan? Separate as a goal from an objective?
Well, that's right. If it's classified as a goal, it's not an objective, but it wouldn't be relevant to the non-compliant gateway test. Well, that wouldn't be.
Finally, Mr. Ferguson, just on page 22, in terms of the purpose of 3.1, this chapter, the new objective there in terms of interpretation, if that's not got anything aspirational in it, could it be something else, such as an explanatory statement and achieve the same purpose?
Yeah, potentially. I was just trying to provide the panel with some assistance on perhaps what's been coming through the replacement or the independent hearing panel in Christchurch. They had a very clear statement around the hierarchy of the strategic directions chapter. And it sort of did that in about three different ways, but one of which was it had an objective, which was exactly as much as it was there. So it provided for a statement or an objective which sort of provided that guidance there. All of the other objectives and places and all the other chapters of the plan are expressed and achieved and they're consistent with the strategic directions chapter. And it also provided for that statement of purpose, which is what A and B provided, which is the descriptive component. And the third way in which it did it was to their strategic directions chapter provided a statement of objectives only and no policies. It's just a food for thought. I mean, I kind of like the theory of having something which deals with the, the dependencies between different chapters. So if you have a chapter that deals with landscapes, you have a chapter that deals with rural areas, and take the example of the ski areas, for example, you've got some way of which you can sort of stitch together these issues. How can you reconcile these competing demands for the same resource? And I kind of like that idea of having a strategic group as a chapter that does that. And I think the way that they expressed it in the Christchurch was, to me, it was a good example.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Three questions only. First, probably the easiest. The bottom of page 12, the evidence of medicine, can I suggest to you the last bullet point doesn't make sense if you're missing the verb? And if you're missing a whole clause, probably. So if you're coming back to us, you might care to reflect on what you are actually trying to say in that bullet point.
This is the urban growth policy that relates to.
No, at the last bullet point on page 12 of your evidence. So, yes, it is the urban growth policy. The spatial growth of Queenstown, so that the role of other settlements and townships in providing various things, and then what? Let's say, if you're coming back to us, don't try and do it now on the fly. Just need some more words. Next, turn to page 5. What's your definition of functional need? Do rural lifestyle dwellings have a functional need to locate in the rural environment? If that's in, what is it?
In that particular part of the policy, I don't think I need to define rural living because that's provided from another policy, from another objective. But I was more thinking of rural sort of contracting depots or some other activity that which locates in the rural area because it needs to be in the rural area for its functioning of farming activities and rural activities.
Or perhaps tourism, given that it's not a big call for bungee jumps in the middle of Queenstown urban areas.
Well, I think it probably also picks up on that point. What is the rural zone? I tried to point out some of my notes about that, that includes national parks, rivers, lakes, rural land, and everything outside of the urban growth areas. It's quite a diverse resource in what it provides for.
Now, the other point, at the end of paragraph 43, as part of discussion of the issues which you've identified with a preference for agriculture, saying, promoting exotic grass growth over native vegetation. And the proposition I suggest to you is that I was trying to reflect on the consistency of that position with the argument that council was advancing that you should start with the existing environment and indeed the discussion. Perhaps the whole continuance of the ski fields might depend on taking that stance. And would the same argument run that if the outstanding nature of particular landscapes reflects their open character and the fact that they're grassed and all the native vegetation has been burned off in the past, would the same logic suggest the same conclusion that they're now? Better or worse than our part of the outstanding character of that landscape?
Just teasing that apart a little bit, grass or pastoral farming is one way to make an open character, and I don't have any difficulty with that. Farming as a way of managing the landscape with other activities is also can be quite compatible and useful regime. But I think that, when you talk about the statutory criteria that are used to identify and describe what an outstanding natural landscape is, and that naturalness, be, that can positively contribute to the natural character of the natural values of an outstanding natural landscape. So it doesn't have to be, in my view, a predominance of agriculture to achieve that. Because obviously other forms of management of the landscape in terms of what's grown on it, they might also be open in their character, if that's going to be having an absence of buildings. I think that can equally achieve that.
Just for the practical sense, how do you see thousands of hectares remaining open and not used for agriculture? And it's probably hundreds of thousands, to be fair.
Don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to say that it's no longer agriculture and that's important, and that would be important for the landscape. I think it was just in the way in which there is a preference given to the nature of the landscape around agriculture. That is all the culture that is from the genetic.
If you removed, and this is hypothetical, if you removed the agriculture, what would you get?
Well, I mean, there's some probably practical examples that could be drawn on, so to speak. If you, Mototapu Station is an example.
Which one, sorry?
Mototapu Station. Mostly agricultural, but there's been a considerable part of that farm that's been fenced off and retired. They've fenced off riparian margins, they've planted a great deal of that which is not farmed, but it's done in conjunction with farming. So there's parts of the landscape that can be the benefit of natural conservation. Mm-hmm. This could be the retirement of the farm, and riparian margins would be a good example of where that might occur and have a positive impact on natural predators. I'm not saying it has to exclude farming.
We can't rely on just philanthropy, can we, in this district?
Well, that's right. And you often see part of that sort of mix of conservation and development come together in these sort of resistance applications that we see in rural zones, don't we? So the protection of open space or the enhancement of natural corridors, for example, can be part of the positive things that are used to set right against. So it's not exactly sort of philanthropic, and there might be a sustainable outcome that can be derived that might involve some development. So I'm not saying farming doesn't perform part of that. I'm just pausing to consider whether there should be a predominance. That's all.
So from what he's saying, you do agree that openness is a character special value that shouldn't be particular than the rural area?
Well, it's the characteristics of the outstanding natural landscapes.
Yep.
And I think that would be true of the, that would be supported and maintained as an attribute of the outstanding natural landscapes that you would want to retain.
And in the rural zone, what would it?
Well, I mean, if you look at the operative plan, the way that it deals with visual amenity landscapes, it talks about not so much the openness of the landscape, it talks about talks about the Arcadian pastoral character, and you probably have much evidence on what does Arcadian pastoral character mean. But I think that part of that is open, but it's open in a rural sense, but it doesn't have the openness or the key attributes that are part of what distinguishes the natural landscapes.
Okay. The question of whether it should be an ONL quality or natural values, wherever it might lie, do you think that those values or qualities should be defined somewhere within it so that we've got that to assess against?
The proposed regional policy statement took the approach of identifying the values of outstanding natural landscapes within an appendix, for example.
Yeah,
my understanding that contemporary case law on identification of those natural landscapes, you know, based around the amended Pigeon Bay.
So that could be a potentially useful petition?
Yes, I mean, it's sort of, I think the submissions that are following the call corrected, the submissions that we made by the evidence that I gave and the submissions from Darwin Planning on the RPS were whether or not it's set in an appendix or as an actual policy in its own right. But I don't think there's any harm in having the values
enunciated
somewhere.
We're not going to ask you this now, but if it is reconfirmed under QAC, DAB, OCB, front, one thing I would like to ask you if that point to say before it is whether you think there's been adequate cost benefit analysis of applying stronger than the NZ standard to the OEB area, OCB area, where that land obviously applies in that area, so that would be interesting to know.
Can I just ask, sorry, are you asking, has there been sufficient standard evidence prepared to justify a higher than New Zealand standard approach to the OCB by the airport?
Or
by anyone?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
So have you also done the counter? Objective 3.2.1.4, you suggest changing it. And in so doing, we have actually taken out reference to the values of the sensitive approach to taking to rural amenity landscape character, health care, assistance, and maintaining values of interest, which means you've removed them totally. And what you're suggesting is doing is recognising the potential for the activities without any constraints. Was that deliberate?
I think it was deliberate to sort of recognise that the rural areas are based on the values for a range of different activities. That was the intent. In terms of Ngāi Tahu rights and values, yes, I have considered that, and I think that in my view the Ngāi Tahu rights and values and interests shouldn't, in my view, form a subset of that particular policy. I think it diminishes their significance. And in my view, the Ngāi Tahu interests and the resources of the district should be recognised and provided for within a separate strategic objective and policy, and that is already there in terms of, I think it's under the series goal for
3.2.7.
Yeah, I just felt that it was making it some senior to really fit in mind.
Okay, so that's for the
night.
What about the rest of the rural amenity landscape character of the ecosystem? Is there no role in when you're valuing the potential of the resources to enable tourism and prominent rural living and Dunwoody's range of rural basic activities? Should that not be balanced against the importance of rural amenity landscape character of the ecosystem?
I do think that should be part of the overall strategic policy framework, absolutely. But what I'm saying is that I think that policy has bit of clarity if it's sort of anticipating the types of activities and articulating what those activities could be. And I think that in my mind, when I was thinking about the bits that were left out, they were adequately covered elsewhere in the plan. And there's the whole section within the goal 3.2.4 that deals with the protection of natural environment and ecosystems, for example, which I thought spoke better on that issue than putting it within this policy. So in principle, I think it's important, but perhaps just not in that provision.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other comments?
No, thank you.
Looks like we've got a few minutes to come back to you on.
Yes, that's fine.
We'll do that as soon as we can. And it may be that if there's a reconvening to consider the porpoising on the airport loading meters, could be a good time to.
Well, we would prefer, if at all possible, if those matters could come back to us by Thursday.
By Thursday?
Hmm. So we can consider them over the weekend.
Things.
Yes, I know.
Right, we'll do.
Thank you. next on the list I've got Daniel Bruce, who's frustrated. Is there anyone here representing them?
Outside the door.
No, I think that's. I think that's Dame Elizabeth Hannon. Could you let her know that she'll be on the list? Oh, is he outside as well? Okay. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you. We'll see you next.
I usually have that sort of success.
Did you see my face off?
Sorry, there's a rather quite poor.
It does.
I guess that's why we were made waterproof.
This is the window on the table in the room.
Oh, I see.
My name's Daniel Drews. I'm an employee of Contact Energy, and I've been employed as an environmental advisor based at the Clyde Dam since February 2006. I have 17 years' experience in resource management, specific expertise in marine fisheries management and water management. I held a master's degree from University of Canterbury. My role at Contact includes responsibility for managing Contact's resource consents and environmental responsibilities, including compliance, reporting and sourcing required permissions. In the years I've been with Contact, I've covered a broad range of issues, including water, landscape and other resource management issues related to hydro generation, both at a regional planning and district planning level. This has also involved particularly liaison with stakeholders such as Kaitahi, Kiatago, Fish and Game, and Koifa, which are the Queensland Lakes and Otago Regional Councils.
I think that's the best that we can take the.
Yeah, I was just going to start
I've got a contact and maybe the summary is read.
There's one point I'd like to make. Obviously, Contact's an electricity company that makes around 23% of New Zealand's electricity, and within Otago we have our major assets at Roxburgh, the Roxburgh Dam, and Clyde Dam, and within the Queensland Lakes District, the Hawea Dam.
electricity is it generated at the Harbour Dam, but rather what was stored behind the dam and released. And that provides flexibility and resilience to the contact. Contact operations at Lake Hawea are currently zoned within a special zone known as the Hydro Generation Zone. And that zone provides the sustainable management of hydro generation activities such as at Lake Hawea. And that zone has worked well from a contact perspective. In terms of a summary of the submission, Contact's been acutely aware that stage one of the review does not include the hydro generation zone provisions, and while Contact will analyse and submit on the hydro generation in the second stage of the district plans review, its comments on stage one predominantly include Contact's interests in the landscape chapter. Council's report notes that the proposed district plan, the landscape chapter, and the section 32 report has purposefully been silent on the hydro generation zone. As a result, we've had no real insight into the proposed plan's approach to the hydro generation zone. And while it currently provides adequate recognition of the original framework for hydro generation activity, Contact has left in a position of knowing what will be in stage two and how that will impact upon its activities. So while statements within that report provide some confidence, we remain vulnerable. We seek changes to Objective 6.3.6, Clause 6.4.13, and Policy 6.3.44. I'll now explain those. I won't read Objective 6.3.6, but Contact considers that the proposed plan needs to recognise large-scale hydro generation, which has been a long-standing activity which has been going in the district. It's begun since the 1950s. We believe that the landscape quality, character, visual amenity and the surrounds is susceptible to change on a daily or seasonal basis, including from the artificial raising and lowering of lake and beer levels. Contact has requested that new policy be inserted as follows: recognise that existing electricity generation facilities and structures may cause changes in landscape quality, character and visual amenity on a day-to-day, seasonal or long-term basis. And that wording was slightly different from that one in our original submission. The need for the plan to reflect this issue is well established. During the 2008 electricity crisis, the level of Lake Hawea has kept it basically as low as we could go within consented levels and stayed there for over 2 months. And the Hawea Community Association, who I was working with at the time, consistently and vociferously expressed concern with the lake levels. Those concerns remain, and it's important that council contact and interested parties have some RMA guidance on this matter. It's also worth noting that Contact's operating consents granted by the Otago Regional Council also have a component devoted towards mitigating ongoing effects of landscape and amenity around Lake Hawea. Contact's view is that the proposed new policy addresses an important landscape issue. Adopting it, or words to similar effect, will help to establish and recognise that existing large-scale hydro generation has an impact on landscape character, quality and visual amenity, and helps to ensure that such effects are recognised and provided for in the district plan. The second change that we sought was an amendment to Rule 6.4.1.3. And in its submission, Contact requested an amendment to this rule to exclude specifically zoned and defined hydro generation activities from being subject to the general landscape activities categories. Under this approach, any activity not fitting the definition of hydro generation activities would require a resource consent and thus be subject to the full assessment of the district plan, its rule framework, and the objectives and policies of the landscape chapter. Such a change is consistent with the treatment of other specially zoned and managed activities, such as the ski area activities within the ski area zone. As well as being an appropriate amendment in its own right, changing Rule 6413 will provide the contact with some comfort on this issue in the event that rules in Stage 2 of the plan are altered unfavourably towards it. And there, a proposed amendment is set out, just the words hydrogeneration activities within the hydrogeneration zone. Policy 6.3.4.4 indicates that large-scale renewable electricity or new mineral extraction activities are not likely to be considered compatible with the maintenance of the district's landscapes. 42A report tells us that it isn't intended to be applicable to the hydrogeneration zone. However, as it's currently written, the policy will apply to all large-scale renewable generation, while referencing only new large-scale mineral extraction. Contact's original submission was that the policy should be deleted because it inappropriately predetermined the outcome of a resource consent hearing. And while that's still Contact's preferred position, we think now we could also amend that text so that it only relates to new electricity generation development. And there we've set out the change to Contact seeking, and it's just the addition of the word new in line two. Land acquisition. In the Stage 1 submission, we indicated that the extent of the hydro generation zone has changed over the years, and this was an issue that was picked up in the Council's 42A report. It's quite correct that there have been changes in land ownership and property rights, including Contact not pursuing a formally proposed electric power project. So our submission to Stage 2 of the plan will address that. So in conclusion, Contact's electricity generation facilities in the Queenstown Lakes District are highly significant to Contact and ultimately to the New Zealand's future electricity generation needs. While the hydrogeneration zone in its current form recognises and provides for Contact's operations, it has no way of knowing whether this is to continue or whether Stage 2 of the review will affect the current framework. The reasonably minor amendments to discrete parts of Chapter 6 that we've suggested will help provide assurance, first, that the plan recognises that existing electricity generation facilities and structures can cause significant changes to landscape quality, character and visual amenity on a day-to-day or seasonal or longer-term basis, and that within the hydrogeneration zone, existing hydrogeneration activities should not be subject to the general landscape categories. And there ends Contact submission.
Thank you. Commissioner Cox, have you got any questions?
Yes, just one question. Your 6413 addition there, the hydrogeneration activities, you said that you didn't actually have any hydrogeneration activity, you just had storage, and I'm wondering if you also have accepted on your 6344 that you just add the word new large scale renewable electricity generation. It sounds like you're not anticipating setting up anything new. The storage is already there.
Yes.
Would you be happy to just acknowledge that in this, because your 6413 addition looks like you're trying to be able to put in a HEP scheme, a new HEP scheme, without any landscape assessment?
In my view, large hydro is large, it's like Harvey, it's Benmore, it's big. And I don't actually know if it physically be built within the Queenstown Lakes District, even if we had the opportunity. I guess what we're trying to say is that we want policy 6.3.4 to apply to new activities that therefore not existing ones, and just to use a word that's consistent with the mineral extraction, if we were to keep that at all.
If the suggested additional policy under Section 6 that you suggest on your page 2 recognised within facilities were included, then would you really need the B addition to 6413 project? Would accept how we are as is.
I think Commissioner Gilmore, part of the confusion is that the definition of hydro generation activities includes the storage.
Yeah.
But it's actually based on the definition.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Robinson?
Mr. Bruce, can you tell us what the status of Caltex proposals to insert a generation control structure is?
It'd be fair to say the project's not imminent, but my understanding is we still have those concerns.
Do they have a term? When's the expiry?
I beg your pardon?
Do they have a term? When's the expiry?
I haven't looked at them in many years. I'm not sure.
And in terms of the issue you've identified, potential effect of this, what land use activities does Contact actually undertake within the jurisdiction of QLDC that this plan would need to provide for?
Well, the generation, putting new generation of Kawi Dam, as you just discussed, would be a very good example.
But there are no existing activities that are within the jurisdiction that would need to be provided for that you can identify for us?
In terms of our general day-to-day functioning of electricity, no, but examples that are coming to mind included in our landscape and visual amenity plan, which is required under our regional council consents. Even though example I can think of is that we asked for a certificate of compliance to allow us to better build an existing gate to make it less dangerous. We weren't sure whether we needed a resource consent, so we applied for the the certificate of compliance to put it back on the council. One of the things we did is we put irrigation in to provide the use of community gardens, native gardens they were, and we had to come to QLDC to have a hearing that they had, and I'm not certain sure the actual status of that hearing. But that was to get a water allocation to allow irrigation to occur.
Can I just ask one question? So you're suggesting you might put in generation additional two storage at Nauru? Okay, so in that case, wouldn't you think that why do you think the landscape assessment shouldn't apply if there's already community concern about the storage?
I think Mr. Drews was talking about existing consent.
True. Good one, thank you.
It's really only the first two pages that I'm concentrating on at the moment, which is a summary of what we want to put forward. Firstly, apologies from Murray Hannon, who's urgent commitments, but I've brought my grandson Jack Hannon, who's the future, and in 10 years' time he'll probably be submitting on the next district plan.
Mm-hmm.
So he's getting a taste of it now. We've been 274 parties over the past 6 years in PC 29, 30 and 39, so we've got an understanding of pressures of the developers around Arrowtown, which is where we're interested. The strategic direction for the district plan as laid out in the summary form clearly looks at the overall effect of the rural-urban zoning to enable long-term benefits to the region. In fact, we, in our submissions, we've emphasised the value of the now established urban growth boundaries agreed under PC 30, operative November 2010. The UGB of Arrowtown in particular recognised the predominant views of the residents, which took in the special character and historic centre as well as the capacity of the primary school. The Ministry of Education submission, which is 524, emphasises this point. By formalising the UGBs under option 2, page 24, there are associated litigation costs to council with potential increases in plan change requests seeking to amend the UGBs. If the UGBs are formalised, then the developers are aware of the requirements of the district plan. The refined UGB under PC 29 for Arrowtown allows for a further development within the boundary of 20 houses in the McDonnell Road region. Further to this, the PC 39 Arrow South Environment Court decision 2015 provided limited rural lifestyle special zone beyond the boundary, but also designated McDonnell Road as the absolute line between the development and the rural zone beyond. Under Goal 2, any further residential development should be within the UGBs to prevent further erosion of rural land for rural residential, rural lifestyle, so-called affordable housing, or retirement villages. Thus, submission 88 to request 25 units in Job Street adjacent to the UGB must be declined. It was recently litigated and refused in the Environment Court May 2015 under PC 29, and it would certainly impact on the school role. As an aside, the land is currently used as a horse paddock, which is essential for rural lifestyle residents needing horses who need grazing. And as council-owned land, it must be retained as rural, respecting decisions recently made in the Environment Court. That's a little addition to what's not there. Goal 4 emphasises protection of natural environment and ecosystem, hence the need to limit urban growth in rural landscapes. We object strongly to 403.1 sitting on the land on the wrong side of McDonnell Road to permitting a change from rural general to rural to rural residential. This is contrary to all the recent proceedings in the Environment Court, which was decided May 2015. This would mean housing is visible from Potter Avenue, as well as many viewing other points, despoiling the rural backdrop, so it must be declined with the original and proposed map designation retained. There is also potential for runoff of contaminants into the little stream flowing through part of the property into waterways used downstream as potable water. Further traffic exiting onto McDonnell Road and potential of school-aged children are also considerations. There is no obvious demand for sections or housing in the urban area on McDonnell Road now, so why jump the boundary? The operative and proposed district plan must have some worth. Likewise, 437.1 to change the Hills Golf Course into a resort zone with multiple housing units. We're especially concerned at housing development at 8, which is exits onto McDonnell Road, opposite the housing, and adjacent to the boundary of 82 McDonnell Road, our property, which our family have owned since 1964. This is a known ponding area where bird life abounds. The track to the clubhouse from there goes along our rear boundary fence right next to our house, and at busy times now, the traffic can be noisy and destroy the rural atmosphere. Further traffic would exacerbate this and be noisier and obtrusive in the building near the road, disfiguring the rural aspect from all the land on the other side of the road. The extra houses and buildings now proposed for the resort are contrary to the original concept of keeping the area green, even to underground housing. If the resort goes ahead, then I think we would certainly like to consider that A8 be declined. Further along McDonnell Road, under 443.1, to change again from rural to rural lifestyle, though there are no extra exits onto McDonnell Road, also impacts on the overall traffic and infrastructure requirements of water, sewage, stormwater, and putting further strain on parking in the central business district of Arrowtown by residents living there. This will also impact on the walking trail at that side of McDonnell Road. The cumulative effect of many submissions, particularly those around Arrowtown, have the effect of creating wall-to-wall housing and imposing restrictions on infrastructure, water supply, sewage disposal, roading and traffic. the strategic and integrated management of urban growth under the following sections must be preserved. We noted to recommend the removal of sections 3.2.2.1.1 and the following sections following is a mistake. The sections should strengthen what has recently been decided in the Environment Court under the proper procedure, that is 3.2.2.1.1, apply urban growth boundaries around urban areas with the following clauses to avoid urban development outside of the UGBs, manage the form of urban development within the UGBs, the residential development close to town centres, local shopping centre zones, activity centres, public transport routes, and non-vehicular trails, ensure the UGBs have zoned land for future growth, which is true for Arrowtown, and minimise the effects of subdivision use and development on landscapes. Therefore, the strategic direction proposed, with goals of enhancing and developing the district to retain its values, environment and economy, must not be overruled by developments creating urbanisation of whatever style beyond the UGBs. The UGBs are a useful planning tool. The net effect may be to destroy those very qualities that tourists and residents expect. As planner Marion Reed says, the value of rural areas and landscapes are intrinsic and economic. When you compare Melbourne Road to Franklin Road, it is the rurality, the rural nature, that is enjoyed by tourists and locals alike. McDonnell Road, leading into Melligan's Road, is already becoming a busy bypass road, with traffic avoiding the chaos of Frankton Road to go to Queenstown. The district plan must have integrity and be relied on by planners and people. It's easy to succumb to pressures and kill the goose that lays the golden egg. On a cost-benefit analysis, it might also destroy the advantage Arrowtown currently enjoys and its differentiation from urban townships in the district. Just as an aside, Submission 18 gives indicators that's attached to that for population growth and certainly quality versus quantity. And that was from my husband, Murray Hannon. Thank you. Jack might want to say something. He's supporting the submission.
Hmm? Commissioner Cox, do you have any questions?
No.
Just one question, Elizabeth. You've laid out a strong position to oppose the urban growth outside the urban growth boundary. We've had a discussion as to how Millbrook should be categorised as an existing operation. Do you regard that as an urban development?
Millbrook is a special resort zone. Millbrook should not be classed in the same position as the Hills Golf Course. Millbrook is a resort zone. Resort zones have its own special characteristics, rules, designations under the district plan, which is different from rural general or rural.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you the same question. So we have no other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name's Josh Licken, I'm the Lord Cats Out for Pinamu Body Corporate Committees. And to my left would be Mr. Walsh, but thank you to the panel for their flexibility in excusing him. He's unexpectedly going to become a father tomorrow morning.
He's not very observant.
No.
Okay, but it's going to be tomorrow morning, that's unexpected.
Hopefully he's worked it out. If not, he will very quickly.
I guess he's being all out
of time. I'll pass that on. But you'll be able to raise that with him later in the year. He'll go attend the later chapters.
Yeah. Has he been able to answer those questions that we provided?
Oh. I'm sorry, I haven't been given any questions.
That might be in the email that I sent that wasn't received. I'll have to check.
Okay, I'll make sure.
Yes, we sent that last week.
Ah, sorry about that. I'll make sure he gets those, and perhaps I could respond and cover memo.
Yes,
if you'd like.
Perhaps by next Wednesday.
Wednesday,
next week.
Not
next week, yeah.
Okay.
Lots
of waking hours.
Yes,
really late at night in the morning.
He won't need to sleep. So. No, sorry about that. I hadn't got that. So I'll make sure he responds to those. And hopefully you've got my legal submissions in front of you now.
Yes.
I'm not sure if the panel's had a chance to read them or not.
No, that was in the email I was just referring to. Apologies.
Okay. Sorry about that. I've been far those that you haven't had a chance to read them. So I'll perhaps traverse through them without reading them word for word, but let me know if I'm going too fast. So these legal submissions are on behalf of the Pounamu Body Corporate Committee, so are actually four body corporates that represent the four buildings that make up the Pounamu apartment complex. And Pounamu Apartments are a luxury five-star apartment complex, and I've attached a picture which you've all probably driven past the apartments along Franklin Road as an actual link to my submissions. The Pounamu Apartments are highly rated, and they've recently won awards as the second best accommodation in Queenstown and third best in New Zealand. And the design of the Pounamu Apartments in terms of footprint is heavily influenced by a wider scheme, which I've also attached to the legal submissions, which shows a hotel complex and behind Pounamu Apartments. Now, that site's not owned by my client, and that hotel, as proposed there, hasn't happened, but I've just attached that as to give a bit of context as to why the Pounamu Apartments are designed in the way they are, and to give you an impression of what potentially could happen in the future. And that was to be a Hilton hotel, but that then went to Kauai Falls, so things have moved on since then. So over the page, I've just set out the Body Corporate's overall submission, which is in support of the proposed plan, and that it seeks to ensure that appropriate development controls are achieved, but also having regard to the neighbours' amenity. And in terms of evidence, Mr. Walsh for the Body Corporate considers that appropriately located higher density neighbourhoods can bring a multitude of benefits, and Mr. Bird for the Council's set out benefits as well. There's certainly no disagreement there. However, the Body Corporate does have some concerns, in particular that the proposed plan does not strike an appropriate balance between providing for the residential intensification while achieving avoiding low-quality, poorly designed infill developments through the high-density zone provisions. And in light of that, Mr. Walsh has proposed amendments which are set out in his evidence and also in my legal submissions, and it sounds like you have a few questions about that, which I say do strike the appropriate balance and better achieve the purpose of the Act. And I say Mr. Walsh's amendments achieve residential intensification, which is sought by the Council, without unnecessarily compromising residential amenity and character to an unacceptable degree. So that's the overall submission, and with your leave, I'll perhaps take it read the statutory considerations, in that I'm sure you've heard them all before, and there's no particular unusual quirks from a legal point of view in terms of the body corporate's submission. So perhaps if we move to paragraph 26 on page 5, the majority of the body corporate submission relate to the high density chapter, and you'll see both myself and Mr. Walsh later in the year in relation to that. In relation to this hearing, the strategic directions, the body corporate considers it's important to have higher order policy framework which guides the implementation of those high density provisions. And the council's expert considers this as good practice, and Mr. Walsh agrees in that respect. Turning over the page and paragraph 29, although supportive of intensification of residential development, the body corporate considers that this intensification must be appropriately balanced with the protection of the amenity and character of existing neighbourhoods. And both the council's expert and Mr. Walsh have identified what none of us want to have happen, which is badly designed high density developments and neighbourhoods. And my submission signalling this balance in the strategic directions chapter will ensure that the application of the rules that will follow do not result in intensification to the detriment of the amenity and character that Queenstown is internationally renowned for. And in Mr. Walsh's view, success is dependent on striking the right balance between achieving higher densities and maintaining, or indeed improving, the quality of that living environment. And Mr. Walsh and his evidence has therefore set out some relief that FEDA achieves that, and that is well within the scope of the original body corporate submission. So perhaps the best thing is to move to that relief, which is paragraph 33. As I said, Mr. Walsh considers the balance between intensification and amenity protection can be better expressed within the strategic directions chapter. And there's two aspects to that. The first is the 3.1 purpose. Mr. Walsh has proposed an additional sort of purpose there, which there's actually a typo in my legal submissions, but not Mr. Walsh's evidence. The addition that he proposes is attractive residential neighbourhoods with distinct character, not district character. So I take the blame for that one. So refer to the experts, not the lawyers. That flows from goal 3, which is a quality built environment taking into account the character of individual communities. So Mr. Walsh considers it's important up front to have that expressly provided for within the list of special qualities. And I say that given goal 3, including a consideration of character of individual communities in the purpose section, is important to shape the goals, objectives, and policies, and eventually rules that follow. And that also better gives effect to the RPS. I won't read out that paragraph. And the second amendment, which is over the page in Mr. Walsh's evidence, relates to goal 3.2.2 and a policy that sits within that. The body corporate agrees with the intent of the policy that's as it's proposed, however considers it is more appropriate to split that policy in two. So the first part relates to the form of the built environment responding to established character, and the second part that Mr. Walsh has proposed relates to the effects on that character by ensuring that any changes to established character contribute positively to the amenity, quality and enjoyment of the area. As notified, that policy anticipates that increasing density will result in some change of character. And Mr. Walsh considered that what the council hasn't addressed is that there needs to be explicit policy direction to ensure that any change is a positive change, not a negative change. And Mr. Walsh considers that that will better achieve the council's own objective, being to promote a well-designed and integrated form. In my submission, this amendment will create a better balance in the strategic directions chapter between encouraging intensification while protecting amenity and recognising and respecting local character, which is an outcome sought by both the council and the body corporate. So there's certainly no disagreement there. Moving down to the next section, paragraph 43, I've just stated that the body corporate agrees with the goals and outcomes sought in the strategic direction and the urban development chapters. However, that the refined relief better achieves the outcome sought in the plan. And in that sense, Mr. Walsh has considered Section 32AA and agrees with the Council's assessment, so hasn't considered he needs to add any further evaluation, and that what he's proposing better achieves what's already assessed. So just to tie that all off, in my submission, the proposed plan needs to encourage both increased intensification but also a high-quality amenity in residential developments through high-quality design that considers the effects on neighbours and neighbourhood character. And there's no disagreement from the Council or ourselves on that. The body corporates for fine relief will provide the necessary higher order policy direction to ensure that that balance is appropriately achieved. And in my submission, this will significantly assist in ensuring that the application of the mechanical provisions that follow have an appropriate focus and balance. So happy to answer any questions that I can answer, or pass on any questions that are better addressed by Mr. Walsh. And just to signpost at the end there that we will be presenting legal submission to the at the next stage. I'm sorry that you don't have the answers in front of you now, but I'll make sure you do.
Obviously, an issue of the email communications.
Yeah, that's right, we'll get there.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I just want to confirm, when do we need those responses from Mr. Walsh?
I was hoping by first thing on Wednesday morning, next week.
Next week, yes, that's fine.
Or tomorrow, that's it.
While he's waiting around.
He's got time.
I'm sure his wife is also my colleague.
You can hold your hand up and run and run.
Exactly. Multi-task.
Yeah, hopefully he's still.
Thank you.
At this point, would have to send my apologies to Mr. McDonald.
Okay.
If he's not here now, then I think it's unlikely he will be here today.
It'll save us 10 minutes then.
That will save 10 minutes, and the contents of what he wanted to say today would be out of place in the later hearings anyway, so I'm sure he'll get the chance to talk then. I'm here on behalf of Fortune McDonald. Prepared a brief summary, but it is actually extremely brief in that you may want to ask some questions rather while whilst peruse it, if there's anything in there that's too out of character with the remainder of the evidence, really.
Just going to your qualifications and experience. Just paragraph 4, could you give us some more details about your experience in terms of district plan policy development?
District plan policy development, I was involved at Auckland City Council as a senior planner, where I was working with the policy department during my term there, and I have been involved in the preparation of policy documents towards private plan changes.
Just in terms of overall, the submission that you're speaking to was there's four Clark's books from McDonald and Associates.
That's right.
And then, and you've signed off the, you've signed the submission on behalf of that. So, that being the case then, are you appearing here as an expert?
That's right.
In terms of, how does it go when you, you've the authority from your employer to appear?
From Mr. McDonald, yes.
From the firm? Is it, it's just not stated in your evidence.
Right, that's right. No, yes, I do. I do have the authority to appear before you.
The reason I'm asking these questions about providing expert evidence, it's the submission which you've signed off. So I'm assuming that you've got some interest in the outcome of the submissions.
Yes.
So then, if that's the case, then how does that relate to being independent in terms of providing the evidence, expert evidence, to us at the same time?
Right. So you're suggesting that in order to present evidence, so external of Butch McDonald?
Apologies, I can't hear you, sorry.
You're suggesting that in order to talk to the submission made on behalf of Clark Butch McDonald, well, no longer would you need to sign an independent of Clark Butch McDonald. I'm not quite sure if I understand.
That might be a solution to it, but I'm just trying to understand that if you've got a submission that you've signed and you've got an interest in the outcome, how do you then present expert evidence on it when you're supposed to be independent and objective? That's
sorry,
what I'm trying to reconcile.
If I could refer to you, the